Okay, where did we, what muscle did we finish on last week, please? Lateral pteroid? Oh, what just happened here? Why is this? There we go. Sorry. Okay. So, I don't know why that turned off. So, we did masseter, we did temporalis. They are both elevators. And as I said, when we were talking about sort of working in and doing TMJ stuff, there you go. We were into these elevators, this temporalis and this masseter. These next ones are very important. I remember I talked about, the muscle that has fibers that attaches partly to the disc that moves the disc when the mouth is opening. That's this one. All right. So it attaches from the sphenoid bone to the mandible and the TMJ, and it has two heads. So you'll see here that there is a superior head and an inferior head, and you can see how the superior head does actually, within the joint capsule and the disc, have some fibers that actually attach anteriorly to the disc. So the superior head goes from the greater wing of the sphenoid to the capsule and the articular disc of the temporomandibular joint. And the inferior head, again, goes from the lateral surface of the lateral pterygoid plate of the pterygoid process of the sphenoid to the neck of the mandible. I said to myself the other day, self, I may have to get a little more particular in terms of the sphenoid with these pterygoid plates because I do refer to them. Just understand that when we look underneath here, there's a couple of very thin plates that are part of the sphenoid underneath, and that's where they find attachment to. So, the superior head goes to the greater ring of the sphenoid, and then the inferior head goes to the lateral surface of the lateral pterygoid plate. These are two thin plates that come down from the sphenoid, and of course, the lateral one on the lateral aspect of it is where we find this muscle attaching to. It protracts the mandible at the TMJ, and it contralaterally deviates the mandible at the TMJ. So that means that to slide your chin left, your right has to contract. Does that make sense to anybody or no? So we have to think that this muscle runs from that sphenoid and goes directly back to the disc, like so. Okay? So we've got two muscles on either side here, and it's coming sort of the direction of my fingers. So when the right one contracts, that would bring the condyle closer to the anterior face. Right? So if the condyle's back here, and the pterygoid plate's up here in the sphenoid, that would mean that when the right one contracts, it's pulling that condyle closer to the front of the face. Therefore, when just the right contracts, we get lateral deviation, or we get this lateral deviation to the left, and when the left one contracts, we get lateral deviation to the right. Again, the articular condyle is moving more anteriorly. In other words, it's moving closer to the insertion or the anterior attachment to this muscle. Yeah, but I don't understand what you mean. So what's happening? If you try to feel your TMJ and your articular condyle and move your chin from one side to the other, do you feel it come forward? So it's coming anteriorly closer to the anterior attachment, which results in the chin deviating to the opposite side. So when the right one contracts, the chin goes to the left. When the left one contracts, the chin goes to the right. This is kind of important because we can work it backwards by stretching it. So if I want to stretch the left lateral pterygoid, what direction do I want to go? No, to the left, right? Because I've got to get the two attachments farther away from each other. So to stretch the right, I want to. So try that. So just take your jaw, right? Let's say let's stay with the right one. So you're going to just relax your jaw and push it to the right and be somewhat assertive with it and see if you can feel the stretch. And you may have to actively work with it. So take it and it might get a bit uncomfortable. For some of you, feel the stretch? Yeah. Okay. So what you're doing is, again, you're taking this part of the temporomandibular joint and the attachment, and you're making it go farther away. So therefore, you're getting the stretch. Okay. So it's a contralateral deviator. So therefore, if you want to stretch the right one, you deviate to the right. Okay. Ow. Yeah. So when the right one contracts, the chin goes to the opposite side. It goes to the left. Right? That's what we mean by contralateral deviation. Now, when they're working bilaterally, what do you think they do? When they work bilaterally, they are an opener. Right? So when they work bilaterally, it's pulling a little bit forward on that. Innervation is trigeminal nerve, cranial nerve 5, the lateral pterygoid nerve. So we can see it here. Here's our two heads here and here. And we see masseter. Part of the mandible has been removed here that we can see, so we can get in and have a look at it. This slide's fairly deep. Now I've had arguments with physios that have been trained to say that we cannot palpate the lateral pterygoid because it's too deep. But I would beg to differ because I've had my finger up there and I can get there, I think. Or at least having some effect on the muscle when. Right? Again, it's a treatment that you'll get to a little bit later on. So contralateral deviation is to the opposite side. So as I said, anterior, inferior, and lateral glide of the mandibular head and disc. And then ipsilateral deviation would mean to the same side. So this would be posterior, superior, and medial glide of the head and disc. So I had a video here. I don't know if it works anymore. I'll have to see. I think it works. No. Oh, there it is. Is it going to work? Yeah, sometimes this stuff just goes wonky. I video myself, but when you're in lab, just have a look. Have your partner just lateral deviate, get a sense of the feel of the movement that's occurring. Now, protraction and retraction is extending the jaw or tongue forward. So sticking your tongue in, it's actually protraction. Okay? And then retraction, of course, is bringing the jaw or tongue back. So I'm protracting here, and you can see that the mandible has moved forward to some degree. So to stretch is exactly what we did. So either the patient can do it themselves actively, or the therapist can do it passively while the client is on the table. Trigger points here, again, this gum chewing, clenching, that kind of stuff can be a problem. These tend to produce pain into the temporomandibular joint itself, can cause a bit of crepitus, so that clicking and popping because again, if it's tight, it's going to get that disc and put it a little bit in the wrong position. You get restricted deviation, occlusal asymmetry. This can cause a bit of tingling in the cheek or weakness of the buccinator muscle, which is in the cheek. It can be incorrectly diagnosed as a TMJ disorder, sinusitis, tic de la rue, which is a nerve issue in the face, or ear infections. It doesn't cause ear infections. It just sometimes gets misdiagnosed as an ear infection. So that was the lateral pterygoid, and we can see where it is here, laterally out here, and it's compared to medial pterygoid, which lies deep on the inside of the mandible. So we can see it here. So here's lateral pterygoid here, sort of in that lateral perspective. And then medial pterygoid is so medial that it actually comes and attaches to the inside of the mandible here. So medial's back in this area here. Okay? So there are two heads, of the deep head and a superficial head. The deep head arises from the medial surface of the lateral pterygoid plate of the pterygoid process of the sphenoid, the palatine bone, and the tuberosity of the maxilla. And the superficial head is the palatine bone and the maxilla, and they both go to the internal surface of the mandible at the angle and the inferior border of the ramus of the mandible on the inside, and you can see it here. So here's our lateral pterygoid that we can see here on this aspect of the jaw. Of course, we're looking from behind, looking at the back of the mandible, and we can see medial pterygoid here. So here's the pterygoid, lateral pterygoid plate right here. We can see it right here without the muscle on it. So it's just this fine, thin part of the inferior part of the sphenoid bone. We can see it, medial pterygoid attaches sort of on the medial aspect, whereas lateral pterygoid attaches on the lateral, and it comes into the inside here of the mandible. Oops. Functions, it's an elevator. It protracts the mandible of the TMJ, and it too is a contralateral deviator. And this is the trigeminal nerve, cranial nerve 5 as well, the mandibular division. To stretch it, you can see it's down and over. So you're depressing and lateral deviating on the same side because it's a contralateral deviator. So much like lateral pterygoid, or if you wanted to stretch the right one, you deviated right, be the same thing with this one, except this is more of an elevator than lateral pterygoid is, so therefore depression and ipsilateral deviation will stretch this muscle. So give it a try on yourself. Pull down. So if you want to do the right one, pull down, open as far as you can and pull it right. And be aggressive. And again, if you've got a bit of a TMJ issue, you'll feel the stretch. What's that? Yeah. Trigger points here. Aching pain in the mouth, including the tongue. So this one can cause some tongue pain and throat. Same idea. TMJ pain, occlusal asymmetry, and the pressure pain felt deeply in the ear. Pain or difficulty when swallowing, or restricted depression of the mandible of the TMJ. This quite often gets misdiagnosed as like a chronic sore throat type of thing. The hyoid bone. So did you do that this week in lab? Did you all find it? And did Michelle tell you don't let Brian palpate you?
Yeah.
Damn. I'll say, so you obviously did the larynx, yes? And you did the, what you would call the Adam's apple, right? You kind of did a bit of that? Okay.
What is the Adam's apple?
It's a cartilage, it's part of the larynx. We'll get into that when we do the rest of it. No, it's actually part of, it's a part of it above the rings. You did or you didn't? No, and we will in respiratory when we get to it in AMP. But the reason I'm mentioning it is because it tends to be the part that's easiest palpated, right? Especially in males, it's the enlarged part, right? It's larger in males, hence the reason why we have dark, deeper voices. You know, we call it the Adam's apple. But if you actually palpate it, it feels like the spout of a jug. Feel it? Coming on top of it, it's like the spout of a jug. It actually comes and pours out like a jug and comes together at the tip. Doesn't it? Feels like a spout. Okay? So now that you're there, the hyoid is superior to that. So quite often students get kind of caught in thinking of the one of the cartilages of the larynx. You actually need to get way up. The hyoid bone is much higher up, and you need to get to either side of it, and you'll feel it, and you can move it. Very movable. And some of you will be a bit crunchy, and you're a bit crunchy. Yeah, that can happen. That's just a bit of crepitus because it maybe needs to move a little bit. No, you got to get in there. You're not anywhere near it. You got to get in there. It does tend to affect some people who have, you know, a bit of a sensitive gag reflex, that kind of stuff. You know, some patients can get kind of gaggy with it. Yeah. But here's the thing about that. If you just grab it with both fingers and do this really firmly, it'll crush. So yeah, it's Brian's first sort of self-defense. So you find yourself in trouble. This thing's pretty vulnerable. Just get in here and grab it and crush it. It'll crush so easily. Yeah. No, you can actually grab it and crush it, and they'll stop bothering you. No, not necessarily. If you crush it too bad, they'll really struggle breathing, and they could die. But if they were about to do terrible things to you, can also punch it. If they've got you in like really tight, just get in there and just get a hold of it. Oh, eyeballs are hard, actually. This is pretty big and fleshy, and you can just get in at it pretty firmly. It's just, I'm not talking a little pinchy, I'm talking about grab it and just go for it, crush it. When we do the clavicle in semester two, I talk about how easy it is to break a clavicle. Just use your forehead and headbutt it. It'll snap like a twig. Right in the middle. Nothing. Yeah. So again, if self-defense, if you find you're in a situation where you've got somebody who's trying to, just take your head and drive it straight down to the clavicle. It'll snap like a twig. Yeah, right in the middle of the clavicle. It'll just. And they'll drop like a sack of potatoes. It hurts, doesn't it? So this hyoid bone is important. It's sort of part of this. It's kind of part of the C spine to some degree when we talk, or the neck. Sorry, I shouldn't say C spine, the neck. So it's found in the anterior neck at the C3 level. It's very mobile, and there is no bony articulation. This bone kind of has a little bit of an association to the laryngeal cartilages, but ultimately it kind of just hangs there. It's suspended by muscles that connect it to the mandible, the styloid processes, thyroid cartilage, manubrium of the sternum, and the scapulae. So you actually have a structure that goes from the hyoid bone all the way to your scapula. Yes. Yes. What's that? I think it's Zomo. Yeah. So it does, you can see it sort of here. Here's your thyroid cartilage here, the one we were just palpating with the spout, and you can see the hyoid bone is slightly above, and you do have a muscle that you can see goes from the hyoid bone all the way down and back to the scapula. And you have some that go up into behind the mandible and below. So we say here that again, suspended by muscles and ligaments, it's bound to the thyroid cartilage. And muscles that originate above the hyoid are called suprahyoid muscles. And muscles that originate below the hyoid bone are called infrahyoid muscles. Kind of a no-brainer. And you can see there's quite a number of them here. Why are these important? Yeah, for us, it's treatment, though. Well, where can you see yourself having to treat these muscles? Yeah. So whiplash, like a car, someone has a significant whiplash. These are structures that we need to consider that we actually could have muscle strains, bruising, tearing of fibers, that kind of stuff. And we need to have a sense of what these are because they can be affected in a significant whiplash. Okay? We'll get back to that when we get to sort of the cervical spine. Part deux. We will talk about the muscles here in the relation. Oh, did I give the wrong slide? Did I put the wrong slide up here for myself? And then it ended, didn't it? Oh, my, the slide that was there, but you have another one below that. Oh, I think I may have given you an old one. We will get back to that. We'll get back to the horns when we talk a little bit later to muscles. Okay, around it. That's kind of strange. Okay, I thought I had the right one up there. All right, so sits in the neck. It's suspended. So we're going to talk now about the muscles that are related to it, and we're going to do the suprahyoids first. So those muscles that have attachment to the hyoid. What's that? I thought I just looked in. Don't you have part two?
No, I
Oh, just a moment, because I thought I just looked and I thought I based it on. Just a moment. So, oh, really? Okay, so that means I did this. I used this one. Okay, just one. So I did this. So that's got the horns. And you're saying it continues with the muscles? I'm looking right here at your blackboard. It's right there. Yeah, so you want this one right here. It's in week three. So I've got muscles related to the skull and face mastication. Oh, I'm in the fall. I've got. Sorry, I thought I was in 24 winter. I have that one left over simply because I have a student who's still waiting for a mark. Okay, so that would be week four then, would it? Winter. So let me see this one. I wonder 23. Yes. She'd have to call. She should call anyways. She should call security because did she slip in the parking lot? She absolutely has to call security because they're going to have to do an incident report. Right. So if she tells she has to call security, they'll have to do a full report because it happened on property, so it has to kind of be looked after. Give me just a second here. Okay, here we go. So we talked about the hyoid bone, and we said there were muscles attached there. So the first ones we're going to do are the suprahyoids. And the best way to remember them is what are supra and what are infra, and kind of break them down accordingly. So the digastric has two bellies. Now what I want you to see here in the digastric, you can see if we look at the orientation here, we've got, the underside of the temporal bone here, and we have a muscle belly that runs here. This would be the posterior belly, and then we have another part of the belly that runs here just under the mandible. You can see to the backside of the mental process. You'll note here there's a little thing here. It's actually like a tendinous connective tissue sleeve that goes over top of it. So we've got muscle belly here. And we've got muscle belly here, and then we have the tendon that runs through this slip that sort of runs it across. So it comes down from the back, runs through that slip, and then goes to the front of the mental process. So the posterior belly runs from the mastoid notch of the temporal bone, and it goes to the hyoid via the central tendon, which is bound to the hyoid bone at the body and the greater horn. And then the anterior belly goes from the mandible of the inner surface of the inferior border, known as the digastric fossa, to the hyoid bone at the central tendon. So if we look here, the posterior body goes from the temporal bone to the central tendon, and the anterior body goes from the posterior aspect of the mandible to the central tendon. So the reality is the posterior belly and the anterior belly meet at the central tendon that's kind of held down by this little sleeve of connective tissue. Okay, so it comes down, does a little hook through, and then goes there. So I'll repeat: temporal bone, the mastoid notch of the temporal bone, to the central tendon, which is bound to the hyoid bone at the body, And then the mandible, of course, to the inner surface of the inferior border to the central tendon at that, which is bound to the greater horn. So we're saying here that the greater horn sort of lies here. We have this central tendon, and it's bound to it by this little sleeve of connective tissue here. So we have the posterior belly back here, and we have the anterior belly here. Okay? Sorry? Yeah, they're right. So you've got, these are the greater horns here. This is the body of it, of the hyoid bone here, and then we have the two greater horns here, and there's lesser horns that come up the top. So we're saying, and you can see how this would be the right one. This is the left one, and you can see it kind of from the inside here. You can see it from the lateral aspect here in its relationship, and you can see it from looking from behind it on the medial aspect of where it is, the central tendon runs through to the horn there. Okay? So just a sort of little loop around. All right? You can kind of see it here in the diagram as well. Here's the greater horn here. Here is the posterior belly of digastric here, just behind the mastoid process. We have this central tendon here. Here's the anterior belly, and we can see this connective tissue kind of sleeve that holds down that central tendon as it runs through from back to front, okay? Next is the mylohyoid. It runs from the inner surface of the mandible to the anterior surface of the body of the hyoid bone. So we can see, again, here is the digastric here, anterior, posterior, all right? And then here we've got the mylohyoid here, kind of this large area in behind. So inner surface of the mandible to the anterior surface of the hyoid bone right here. So we have a left one here, and the right one would be over here. You can see it here as well. Here is the mylohyoid here. So we're looking from behind the mandible. Here is the left one here, and this would be the right one here, okay? Oops, and it depresses the mandible, the TMJ, and flexes the head and neck and spinal joint. So did I do that? Sorry, I didn't do the function of the digastric. So we think of these two muscles coming from posterior, I went back because I forgot to do the actions of the digastric. I apologize. So it runs from the mastoid process, and again, we've got this central tendon at the hyoid bone. So because of where it sits here, you can see how it will cause depression. Can you see? Because of where that central slip is, it will pull the mandible down. So it depresses the mandible at the TMJs, it's primary. It can retract the mandible at the TMJs when working, to some degree, especially the anterior belly. Now it can flex the head and neck of the spinal joints. Now, how's that possible? Where's the axis of movement for flexion of the head and flexion of the cervical spine and the neck? So where does this muscle lie in relationship to the axis that results in head flexion and neck flexion? It's anterior to it, so therefore it flexes it. Because flexion of the head occurs up here posteriorly to where the muscle we're talking about, so flexion occurs here, we're talking here, because it lies anterior to it and runs back to the temporal bone, then when it pulls, it will do this, and then it will do this because of its position, and it's anterior to the spine, right? And it can extend the head and neck of the atlanto-occipital joint. How's that possible? So it flexes the head and neck of the spinal joints. So if we look at it from this position, okay, so you can see how when the anterior belly would pull, you can see how the whole head would come down into flexion. And because we're anterior to the C-spine here, you can see you would also get a little bit of upper cervical vertebra flexion as well. Yes, you can see that? Now, because the posterior belly crosses back to the temporal bone, which now causes it to be a little bit behind the spinal column, the posterior belly results in extension at what is called the atlanto-occipital bone. This is the C1 articulation with the occiput. So the anterior belly causes neck flexion and spinal flexion, And then the posterior belly causes just the head, not the C spine. When you look up, just here. If you get to here, it's C spine, just the head looking up. So you sort of kind of a 45 degree angle. It's reverse motor action. Have we heard this yet? Have I talked about reverse motor action yet? Okay. When we look at its actions here, those are its primary actions, and this is when the hyoid bone is fixed and the muscle is contracting. But what happens if the head and the neck are fixed and the muscle contracts? So in other words, when we say fixed, it means the head and neck can't move. So if the muscle contracts and the head and neck can't move, then what it causes is elevation of the hyoid bone. Okay? Trigeminal nerve, cranial nerve 5. The facial nerve does the anterior belly. So trigeminal nerve 5 and the facial nerve does the anterior belly. And the myelohyoid branch, cranial nerve 5, does the posterior belly. I haven't got it set up right. The trigeminal nerve and the facial nerve innervate this muscle. Anterior belly is the myohyoid branch, cranial nerve 5, and the posterior belly is the facial nerve, cranial nerve 5. Not particularly, no. I mean, to some degree, you can get at it. You'll sort of feel the anterior belly as you get underneath in here, but you're certainly not going to get at the posterior belly. It's far too deep. Yep. Anterior belly is the myohyoid branch, cranial nerve 5, and the posterior belly is the facial nerve, cranial nerve 5. So they're both cranial nerve 5. Posterior belly, though, is the facial branch, and the anterior belly is the myohyoid branch. Yes. Okay. Myelohyoid, we said, is that much larger, takes up a lot more mass in here underneath. We've got, it depresses the mandible, the TMJs, and flexes the head, neck, and the spinal joints for the same reasons that we saw with the last muscle. And again, reverse motor action when these are fixed. It does elevate the hyoid bone. And this is trigeminal nerve, cranial nerve 5, the myohyoid branch as well. We can see it's as much fleshy area in here. And you can obviously get up, if you get up there high enough, you can get into muscle tissue up here. Geniohyoid is the next. Now, geniohyoid, we can see here, runs in goes sort of straight down. So here is our digastric here. So here's the posterior belly and the anterior belly. And then we have the myohyoid here, which is the large expanse in here. And then we have the, geniohyoid, which you can see here running from the hyoid bone straight up to the backside or posterior aspect of the mental process of the mandible. So it runs from the inner surface of the mandible to the anterior surface of the body of the hyoid bone. It depresses the mandible, the TMJs, pulling it down, which would make sense. Flexes the head and neck at the spinal joints as well because of its association being anterior to the C-spine and the head in its position of the axis of the movement. And then, of course, elevates the hyoid bone when the head and neck are fixed. Geniohyoid is hypoglossal nerve, cranial nerve 10, 11, and 12. It's a branch of C1. So this actually is one of the muscles that is innervated by a spinal nerve as well, not just a cranial nerve, which all the ones previously have been. Okay. Stylohyoid, again, its name kind of tells you where it is. The styloid process of the temporal bone to the junction of the body and the greater cornu or the greater horn of the hyoid bone. It just elevates the hyoid bone because of its position. It doesn't have any effect on the head and neck. Reverse motor action, unless it's doing it reverse, it will extend the head at the atlanto-occipital joint if the hyoid bone is fixed. Innervation, facial nerve, cranial nerve 7. So here we now can see, here is our digastric, posterior, anterior belly. Here is stylohyoid here, coming from the styloid process down to the anterior hyoid bone here. We've got the mylohyoid here, which is this fairly thick area here. And then we have the geniohyoid that's coming straight up from the anterior hyoid up in behind here. Okay? That's just the suprahyoid. And you can get lots of junk in here, you know, whiplash, those sorts of things. Oh, you've already bought Bisniak? Yeah, who taught you into that? Oh, do they? Okay, Vizniak's the author. I don't think it's on the CMTO list. That's the problem. No, I didn't think so. It's not a bad book. A lot of the colleges are using it, so I think it's just us telling the CMTO to put it on the reference list for exams. Did anybody else buy it? You're going to? Yeah. Okay, the infrahyoids. So these run below the hyoid, have attached on the hyoid, but they run inferiorly. So the suprahyoids run above. So the sternohyoid runs from the posterior surface of both the manubrium and the sternum and the medial clavicle. So this muscle is running from manubrium, sternum, and clavicle and going up to the hyoid bone to its inferior surface. So here we can see, here's the sternohyoid here. We have the clavicle, the manubrium. It's coming up here into the inferior part of it. We can see it here as well. Here's the sternohyoid that we can see here. Right, it's been cut on this side, but it's running all the way up to the hyoid bone here. Again, posterior surface of both the manubrium, the sternum, and the medial clavicle, and it goes to the inferior surface of the body of the hyoid bone. This muscle pulls the hyoid bone down, so it depresses the hyoid bone, and also because it sits anterior to the C-spine, and it goes up to the mandible, it does flex the neck and the head at the spinal joints. And if those are fixed, then it will elevate the sternum so as to when you're taking a big breath in and trying to expand that rib cage, this muscle will pull the sternum upwards in that deep breath. Innervation, we are now away from cranial nerves. Now we're into spinal nerves. Do you remember where the nerve roots exit in the C-spine? Are they above or below the bodies? Above, right. So this would arise from a nerve that would come up from the top of C1 and then C3, okay? So we can see it here running up, just right in the middle. The sternothyroid is the only hyoid muscle that does not attach to the hyoid bone. So we had the sternohyoid, now we have the sternothyroid. Okay, and it does not attach to the hyoid bone. It arises from the posterior surface of both the manubrium of the sternum and the cartilage of the first rib. So it comes from the cartilage of the first rib. Right here, we're running in this area here. We can also see it sternothyroid here, and coming up underneath, and it does not attach to the hyoid bone. Okay, it runs to the thyroid cartilage of the larynx. And the thyroid cartilage of the larynx is what we were palpating when we were talking about the Adam's apple. So this muscle comes from that area of the sternum and the first rib and comes up to and attaches onto the thyroid cartilage, not all the way up to the hyoid bone. It depresses the thyroid cartilage. It helps like when we're swallowing and it moves. And then it flexes the head and neck of the spinal joints, again, because it's anterior to it. Reverse motor function, it elevates the sternum when all these are fixed. And again, this muscle, cervical plexus, C1 and C3 as well. Omohyoid, again, we're still doing infrahyoids here. There are two bellies to omohyoid. The inferior belly arises from the superior border of the scapula to the clavicle via a central tendon. Okay, so we can see here, here's omohyoid here. It's coming from the scapula, and there's a central tendon here again. So we have a posterior belly, which is back by the scapula, and we have an anterior belly here that comes upwards. So the posterior, here we go. Inferior belly, again, superior border of the scapula to the central tendon, and then we have a superior belly that goes from that central tendon to the inferior surface of the body of the hyoid. So the inferior belly scapula to the central tendon, the superior belly, the central tendon to the inferior surface of the hyoid bone, okay, which you can see here. Scapula to central tendon and then up to the inferior surface of the hyoid bone. Okay, it depresses the hyoid bone and it can flex the neck and head of the spinal joints. And if it's reverse motor action, if these are fixed rather than elevating the sternum, this actually can help elevate the scapula at the scapulothoracic joint. Have we talked about that, the scapulothoracic joint? So when we look at the scapula, it doesn't really have a bony attachment to the thorax, okay? What it does do, it does have a relationship to the ribcage and the thorax, but the scapula is held in place by muscles. Nick, come on up because you have a T-shirt on. I already did a scapular lift for you guys, right? No, maybe not. Okay. So you're going to stay here for a moment. Okay. Yeah, just facing me. Okay. Let me see. Doesn't matter which one. No, we're going to put your arm back here. So you can see already the scapula is somewhat elevated. So the scapula is only articulates with the skeleton, the actual skeleton, by the clavicle. So anteriorly, you can do a little spinning around here. So we've got the clavicle here. It articulates here with the manubrium and then here with the acromion of the scapula. Other than that, the scapula articulates with the humerus of the arm, but the scapula then floats around the rib cage. Okay? So to give you a sense of how much, this is going to seem weird to them, but it's not going to hurt, I promise. But I do have to get close. I can actually grab the scapula and pull it away. Okay? Because the scapula is only attached by muscles. That doesn't really hurt, does it? It feels nice, a good stretch. So I can actually get right underneath it. Sorry, you got a bit of a trigger point there, haven't you? Okay, relax it. Okay, relax. No. Keep your arm where it is, but let your scapula relax. Attaboy. There we go. See, I can pull it away. Okay? That's normal. I should be able to do it with all of you. Some people don't have that. So now what I want you to do, bring your arm down. Okay? I want you to watch this scapula here. I want you just to abduct and adduct. Do you see the movement of the scapula? See how it's rotating? Okay, so watch. I'm going to bring your hand down just for a second here. Okay, there's the inferior angles. Okay, slowly abduct. Keep going. See the movement? Okay, it actually moves, right? And relax. So in order for him to be able to do that, this scapula needs to move and kind of float around the thoracic cage, which allows for it. So that is known as the scapulothoracic articulation. It's not a true articulation where two bones come together. It's just simply the muscles hold that scapula tight to the thoracic cage, but allow for the movement. There actually has to be a movement relationship between the scapula and the humerus in order for him to abduct. Because watch what happens if I lock it. Okay, try to abduct now. That's as far as he can get. Okay? So this is when people have issues with abduction and discomfort. Thanks, you can sit down. Maybe that scapulothoracic articulation isn't functioning well and doesn't allow for the movement to occur. So that's what we mean by when we say it elevates the scapula at the scapulothoracic joint. So that's just the scapula is just sliding upwards, elevating when this muscle works, when it's fixated in these other areas. To do the hyoids, there's lots of different ways we can do them. We can see here that the therapist's way is to do we're doing the right hyoids here, or the patient can do it this way. So it's literally just trying to look up past over the shoulder. And some of you may get up there and go, oh my, because you've got scalenes in there, you've got SCM in there, and they can all be kind of tight. The last muscle we have here is the tongue. The tongue is a very unique muscle. It's extraordinary, as the authors say, because it's a boneless mass that can do all sorts of things, stick out, flatten, turn. This is where everybody kind of has fun in the class because there are very directly connected genetic things that people can do with their tongue that other people can't do. How many people here can flip their tongue, turn it right upside down? Yeah, you can turn your tongue right upside down. Yep, you can do it. And that's genetic. So either your mom or dad can do it. Your dad can do it? Okay. Right? Watch. Sure. Watch. Oh, no, not at all. I can't do that. I can't. You have, genetically, the way your muscles work, someone in your family can likely do that. How many people here can make a tube with their tongue? Yeah, I can't do that. I can't do that with my tongue. Can you do it? Oh, can you? Yes, I can't do that. Can you do it? Oh, wow. No, I can't do any of that. Yep, no. I've had students in the past who can make their tongue go like a snake. They can actually make it wiggle like a snake. And it's just how your tongue is represented in your brain and how your brain can sort of isolate certain muscles within the tongue to do certain things. And it's highly genetic. I can't do any of that. So it's a boneless mass. You can protrude at will, fold, invert, lay flat, or fill the mouth. So, you know, and the tongue's major role, number one, is when we're masticating, right? So when you're eating, the tongue is responsible for moving food around, getting in the place for teeth to crush it, that kind of stuff. But the other thing is speech. Tongue plays an amazingly important role in language. And if someone has had a stroke and they have aphasia, a speech pathologist will come in and have to retrain the tongue to work with the lips and the jaw in order for the patient to be able to speak against aphasia. Because they've forgotten and they need to retrain their tongue. So when you're working with children and you're teaching them language, right? And then there are many languages out there the tongue plays actually even more significant role. So certain languages have clicks and pops that the tongue does in terms of the way language works. So Inuit people, for example, have intonations in the way they talk, and that's all tongue movement that is learned over time where they're able to create those sounds that become part of their language. So I don't get into this huge, but just we need to have a sense of it. So there are intrinsic and extrinsic muscles to the tongue. The intrinsic muscles only attach to other structures within the tongue. So your tongue is also loaded with lots of connective tissue that muscles can attach to and work with. By the way, does anybody here eat tongue? I love eating tongue. Beef tongue is delicious. What's that? Oh yeah, but then you slice it thin, have it on a sandwich with hot mustard, and it's tasty, very tasty. So there are four paired intrinsic muscles of the tongue, and they're named by the direction in which they travel. So there's superior longitudinal, inferior longitudinal, transverse, and vertical muscles. So they all kind of make sense as to where they'd be. So if you see here in the diagram, you can see here's your superior longitudinal, here's your vertical, here's your transverse, here's your inferior longitudinal, and they are divided by a septum. So you do have right and left of the tongue. So this is why, in some particular ways, a patient can have a stroke that's affecting one side of their body. One of the tests you do is ask them to stick their tongue out, and when they stick their tongue out, it will pull to one side or the other, because the one side that's paralyzed can't balance out the two sides, so the tongue goes and does this turn, right? And in fact, sometimes when that's done, also the uvula, your little teardrop, if there's paralysis, it'll hook to one side or the other, because again, one side's paralyzed and the other side isn't. These are folks that can't swallow properly, and they have to have, I always hope this never happens to me, where they gelatinize their water, so they're drinking like really thick gelatin water. That's the only way they can drink. Well, otherwise, they would drown, right? They can't control.
Wait, so you're saying the uvula?
Yeah.
We don't even control the uvula, but it's one way.
If there's a stroke and there's dysfunction and weakness on one side, the uvula will deviate. It's a classic neurological sign. Yeah, it just pulls to one side. Yeah, they'll open their mouth and you'll see it. It'll just go just to one side. Yes. It's a very common neurological test. So, these muscles affect the shape and size of the tongue, for example, in tongue rolling, and have a role in facilitating speech, eating, and swallowing. The motor innervation for the intrinsic muscles of the tongue is the hypoglossal nerve, cranial nerve 12. So again, anything that affects it is going to affect the function of the muscles that are within the tongue. Those are intrinsic muscles, so they're within the tongue. Now there's the extrinsic muscles. Of course, these are just a little bit outside the tongue. So there's the genial glossus, and these are inferior fibers that protrude the tongue, middle fibers that depress the tongue, and superior fibers that draw the tip back and down. Okay? So trying to slide your tip along the bottom of your mouth, the floor of your mouth. Right? Okay? Hyoglossus, it depresses and retracts the tongue. Sialoglossus retracts and elevates the tongue. And palatoglossus elevates the posterior aspect of the tongue. All right, so your tongue does a lot of moving around. Again, helps with speech and language and so forth. All of the intrinsic and extrinsic muscles are innervated by hypoglossal nerve, cranial nerve 12, except the palatoglossus, which has vagal innervation, which is cranial nerve 10. Cranial nerve 10 is a very interesting nerve. When you get into neuroanatomy, you'll talk a whole lot about it. It actually goes all the way down to the gut. So this is why vasovagal responses, when people pass out and get all funky, that's the vagal nerve. And it goes all the way down towards the stomach. And you can see it here. So here are our extrinsics here in yellow, blue, red, green, and purple. We can see how they're kind of holding the tongue up. And then these are your intrinsic muscles here that are within the tongue itself. Okay? Okay. You want to take a break, early break now? Say we'll come back about 22. Yeah, okay. So how this is going to work, if you guys don't mind, how this is going to work, we're going to do all of this first as a spine. So we're going to talk about the spine, the bones of the spine, the joints of the spine, and then we're going to break it down. We're going to do the cervical spine and its joints and the muscles. Then we're going to do the thoracic spine, its joints and its muscles, and then ribs and sternum, joints and muscles, and then lumbar, spine, joints and muscles, a bit of the sacrum, and then the anatomy is done in this course. That's where we're at. And then we do science. We've got muscle physiology of muscle contraction, bone growth, all that kind of stuff to get through. All right, so the spine, also known as the vertebral column. It's commonly called the spine. It is the integral part of what we call the axial skeleton. And, of course, it is stabilized by ligaments, which limit the motion produced by the back muscles, the shape of the vertebrae themselves, and the intervertebral discs. We chose, evolutionarily, to leave four limbs to go to two. Right? So because we walk on two legs, my mother, she probably just heard something, so I'll just let you guys know. They did find something on my voice box. I may have throat cancer, so I actually have to go and get another thing and have enough biopsy done and stuff like that. So it's small. I'm not worried about it. It's just laser or radiation, so we'll see.
Yeah, no big deal.
No, it's okay. anyways. So, oh yeah, I am. I know lots of people who've had throat cancer and they've survived just fine. So we went, what's that? Yeah, Kirk Douglas, or Michael Douglas, there's lots of people. Got it. So we went from four legs to two. And in doing so, we had to do something with being able to hold ourselves up, okay? And we have to remember, what is the greatest influence on us at any given time on this earth? Right. So we have to set up the spine to be able to stand on two legs, stand erect, and also fight gravity, which is trying to constantly push us down to the floor, right? So there are certain adaptations to this spine which allow us to be able to stand and move around and not have to get down on all four. Now, do you remember I showed you the bones in the Royal Ontario Museum of the dinosaurs and so forth? So every mammal has spines, right? It's an integral part of what we do. So when we look at this spine as a whole, we need to consider that I always talk about how the spine is building blocks. So, you know, I think of kids' little blocks, you know, putting one on top of the other. I guess I could almost use like Jenga sort of thing, right? They get, you know, they're piled one on top of each other. So because of that, and because of gravity, it is a susceptible area of the body that relies on activity and strength and so forth. And this is why in our society, and I'll talk a bit about this as we move through it, This is why we have back problems. Number one with a bullet for back problems is exactly what you're doing now. Sitting. Sitting is the worst thing. Some studies have even come out that said sitting is and sedentary is almost worse than smoking cigarettes. So, yeah, it's so bad for you to do nothing, right, to just sit. But you are, the back is made and created for us to be upright standing, not sitting, right? We can sit, but we just sit for so long it comes to be a problem. So when we talk, think of these building blocks, we can call them 33 vertebral bodies. So when you look at your spine there, all the way up, you know, you've got these parts of it. There's 33 of them, okay? Only 24 are movable. So this, it broke some time ago. This is your sacrum. So this is, you know, right just above the bum here, this firm part. And this was inside mum when it was initially being developed, did look like five individual vertebrae, just like these when they were developing inside mum. The movable parts remain individual in relationship to each other, whereas in the sacrum, those five vertebrae fused together to create this solid bony mass that we call the sacrum. And in fact, when you look at it, you can kind of see on the anterior part here where those individual vertebrae were inside mum at one point when they all kind of fused together to form this sacrum. So 24 are movable. Seven represent cervical vertebrae, which is the spine of the neck. 12 are called thoracic vertebrae. How many ribs do we have? 12. So they correlate to each other because the ribs do articulate with the thoracic vertebra. So 12 ribs, 12 vertebra. Well, that's 12 on each side, of course. There are five lumbar vertebra, which make up the lower part of the back. There are five sacral bodies, which are fused together to form the sacrum. And at the very end, there are four what are called coccygeal bodies, which represent, shall we say, the tailbone, which was the vestigial tail in the fetus. When you look in a fetus that's developing, it looks like they do have a little bit of a tail. Reality is they really don't have a tail. What happens is the spine and the neural tissues develop much faster than the body does. So as the body's developing, the spine that's sort of advanced in development, it kind of sticks out the bum a little bit as the rest of the fetus catches up, and then the tail disappears just simply because the fetus develops beyond the spine and the spine doesn't really get much longer at that point. Each of these areas are named by their type of vertebra, and we do use short forms. So C-spine is cervical, T-spine is thoracic, L-spine is lumbar, S-spine is sacrum, and CO is coccygeal, okay? When we count, we begin at the base of the skull because within this fusion of the sacrum, it can screw up sometimes. Sometimes we're going to talk about you get extra fusion and sometimes you get missed fusion. So we always count down from the skull because we don't tend to have those kind of problems in the movable parts of the spine. Vertebral bodies become larger as they approach the sacrum and smaller as they, again, because they approach the coccyx. But with that said, they're also small at the head and large at the lumbar area. So this is a cervical vertebra. And this is a lumbar vertebra. They're distinctly different in size, right? Okay. We're going to learn that there's a reason for that. So this is C-spine. This is L-spine. They progressively get larger. And then as the sacrum moves down towards the coccyx, it gets a bit smaller again. All right. We'll talk a bit as to why that is later on. This is due to the increase in weight bearing in the lumbosacral area. When we get down, you have to understand that, again, we're under gravity. So we have our spine. All of this weighs a lot, doesn't it? Right? So when we're moving around, all this mass comes down on the L-spine. So when we get down into the lower parts here, down into the five here, right? 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. In this area here, in the lumbar spine, all of this mass, head, shoulders, arms, lungs, internal viscera, and so forth, it sits down on top of these lumbar vertebrae. So that's the reason why they're so much larger, because they are taking the considerable amount of mass that lies superior to it, okay? Most vertebral columns are between 72 and 75 centimeters in length, and a quarter of this length is due to discs. Now, your models don't have a disc, and because they would be too difficult. In some cases, we do have some discs here. You can see in this model, they've kind of got some like some felty kind of stuff here that kind of represent a disc. But think that in your spinal, your spines that you've got, there would be a disc between each of those vertebrae. Every single vertebra would be a disc. So it goes bone, disc, bone, disc, bone, disc, bone, disc, all the way down. Okay? So we can see here, 7 cervical, 12 thoracic, 5 lumbar, 5 fuse for the sacrum, and 3 to 5 fuse for the coccyx. We can see them here in color. Yellow is C-spine, blue is T-spine, magenta is L-spine, green S, and purple CO. And you can see the discs here that are lying in between each of the vertebrae as they work their way down. So what's it do? It supports the trunk and limbs. It supports the weight of the skull. I always say that, you know, your cervical spine is a stick with a pumpkin on top of it. Because, you know, you think about, you know, if you look at your cervical vertebra that are this small, and you've got this big head that sits on top of them, right? And so it does kind of support it. And again, gravity wants to take that head and pull it down because it's pushing. It plays an important role in posture during sitting. We already did that. Remember, you had to sit on your hands, right? So when we're sitting properly, the weight that sits on the spine, if the spine is set up appropriately and you're sitting properly, all that mass that comes down on that lower spine transmits through the sacroiliac joints out into the pelvis and takes a lot of stress off the low spine. So the other reason why sitting is so bad for us and causes so much spinal problem is because we sit so poorly, which puts all the mass on those ligaments and holding elements of that lumbar spine, and it starts to break down over time as we get older. In locomotion, it transmits the weight of the body through the pelvis to the lower limbs. You will be doing gait analysis, and you're going to watch this relationship of pelvis and spine when we just normally walk. Is it appropriate or not, right? You sometimes see people doing weird gaits, right, in the mall, right? And because maybe they had cerebral palsy or they've got something functionally going on, you're going to learn what might be not working in those particular type of gaits. And, of course, within this little hole here that we see in here, we've got, you know, these sharp edges in this big body. We see we've got a hole here and a hole here. This is where the spinal cord runs through. So because the spinal cord runs through this space, we can say that this helps protect the neural tissues by being surrounded by bone, okay? So we can see here then, what the hell does a sailboat have to do with the spine? Let's think about a sailboat. If I have a big sailboat that's out on the ocean, I have a mast, right? And on the mast, you put the sail. And the sail is attached to the mast through ropes and so on and so forth. And we get a huge gust of wind that picks up that sail. What do we need to have done to the mast to ensure that it doesn't snap in half when the sail gets filled with wind? Sorry. Okay, that's one thing you can do. What else do they have? What's a sailboat have on it? The old ones. What's rigging? Yeah, ropes going in opposite directions, right? So, you know, you even see that in telephone poles, right? If you get a really tall pole, you'll see a big cable that goes down into the ground that holds the cable from going, all right? So you'll note in this diagram that the majority of mass of this individual lies where in relationship to the spine? Yes, the majority of the mass lies anterior. So if we just think of sort of from a fulcrum or an axis point of view, that means that because most of the mass is anterior to the spine, it wants to come down. It wants to come down and forward just simply because it has weight and it wants to come this way. So what happened? The body put in rigging or ropes. So when we look at the posterior aspect of the body, we have modified or we've created a way of holding up the mast, which is the skeletal system, by way of ligaments, the way the bones relate to each other when we look at the joints of the spine, and by the muscles. We have big, powerful posterior muscles that are always working to keep us upright or erect as kind of normal as we possibly can. So this, again, is why we tend to run into problems with our spines when we chose to stand on two legs, because we're constantly fighting gravity that's constantly trying to bring us down. So again, we have muscles and ligaments and bony articulations that are avoiding that movement at all times. So when we look at the spine in the lateral view, there are curves. There are curves in the spine. It's not straight up and down. It kind of looks like this. So I've got the pumpkin here. I'm going to accentuate them. Okay, kind of looks like that. All right. Now, there are four anterior posterior curves in the lateral view. The thoracic and sacral spines are concave anterior. Okay? The thoracic and sacral spines are concave anterior. So here's the sacrum. Here's the thoracic. You can see they're concave anterior. The term we use for concave anterior is kyphosis. So the sacral spine and the thoracic spine are said to be kyphotic. Okay? Kyphotic. The cervical and lumbar are concave posterior. And they're said to be a lordosis or lordotic. So the thoracic and sacral are kyphotic, and the cervical and lumbar are lordotic. You can have hypo or hyperlordosis or kyphosis. In other words, you can have a lack of curve or an excessive curve. Neither is great. Both can lead to dysfunction of the client, pain patterns, and all those sorts of things. Loss of curves results in weakness of the column, both structurally and mechanically. It's unable to transverse forces. What is that? It's the Colosseum, which was the largest building in the world for an incredible length of time. How were they able to build such a high, tall building so large without it crushing down and collapsing itself? What did the Romans invent? Concrete they did, which built it, but to hold it up, they invented the arch. Right? So they invented the arch, and the whole reason why this building is able to stand is because of these arches. They transfer, because this is made of concrete, can you imagine how much that weighs? And if it didn't have the arches, it would literally crush in on itself. So by having the arches put in, the weight above is dissipated throughout the whole building down into the ground. So there's less stress within the arch, and because the weight above has been dissipated. I'll give you the hint. What's the key part of an arch? Yeah, which is called the triangle at the top, which is known as the keystone.
Oh, yeah.
Right? That's why it's called, yeah, that's the keystone. So that triangular stone in the middle is what crushes the arch altogether, which then dissipates the weight. So what the hell's that got to do with the spine? The spinal curves do exactly the same thing. The curves are integral to removing the stresses and dissipating them so that the spine doesn't get overworked. The moment you lose those curves, you have problems. You're going to discover in the clinical setting, patients who have lower back pain quite often have flat backs. They've lost their lordosis. Hence the reason why they have back problems. So you need to promote them getting that lordosis back. Long and weak, short and strong. Remember that? You don't remember that? Did I do that with you guys? Okay, same idea, right? So if I've got a flat back here, I'm going to be long in the back and short in the front, aren't I? And I'm deliberately doing that. So what do I have to do? I have to elongate and strengthen, and then give you lady push-ups to accentuate that lordosis, right? Get that lordosis back again. So quite often, that's why this is so important to understand, is that with certain pain patterns, patients need to get these curves back again. Okay? Yes. I guess to some degree, yes, but more often than not, it's due to other extenuating circumstances. So, for example, have any gymnasts in the house? No? Dancers? Yeah, so you have this, don't you? Right? So you have an excessive curve in your back, likely promoted by the activity because that's considered to be more aesthetic, right? Same as in ballet or gymnastics. They want that excessive curve in the lumbar spine, lift that chest up, and they end up with a hyperlordosis. What happens is the hip flexors get tight, the hip flexors attach to the spine and literally pull the spine down and forward, so you get the sway back, you get the big curve in the lumbar spine. That's not good. Having too much is just as much as not having enough. Okay? So you need to get these stretched out and elongated, and that curve will come back to a little bit differently. It does, and it flattens the lumbar spine. It can flatten the spine and shorten the hip flexors, which can result in the same problem. No, you shouldn't. It's due to weakness. So that's what happens as we get older. People don't take the time to do core strengthening or become less fit or deconditioned. Then now they're on the road to ruin. This is part of the problem. You're gonna hear me talk about like grandma. When grandma's at the house, tell her to get off her ass and go get her own stuff, right? Because that's what's gonna keep grandma live longer or better. Right, if everybody's running around trying to do everything for grandma and she just sits on the chair all day every day, that's not good for her. She needs to get up and go get. It's quite the fun party trick though. You're all about to start become cursed. You're all going to get the curse. I cannot look at a human being without picking them apart. Like, oh, tight hip flexors. Oh, a lot of you. Yeah, because because what we do, like, you're going to learn an assessment. So, number one start of assessments is observation. So, I watch you take your jacket off when you come in. I watch how you walk into the treatment area, right? All those sorts of things. So, when you start doing assessments class, I highly recommend grab a coffee, go to the mall, sit in one of the chairs in the mall, and just watch and see all the variations of gait, movement, and try to figure out what their problem is, right? And you're going to see all sorts of things, right? That, some of them are preventable by exercise and so forth, but some of them, like someone has cerebral palsy and they're walking like this, right? And, well, we can help them because, believe it or not, as much as, we see somebody with cerebral palsy and we go, oh, they seem to be okay. It's uncomfortable for them. They tend to get muscle soreness, right? Anything. So, when we walk, we have this sort of normal walk. Anything that changes it or changes it is exhausting to the body because it's not efficient. Causes pain, dysfunction, all those sorts of things. So we'd like to get people, if we can, back as close as they can. And if they can't because it's a neurological dysfunction or something like that, then we provide relief through, lengthening muscles, calming down structures, those sorts of things. So this is the fun stuff. This is the stuff that you're going to start to enjoy. But start paying attention. As I said, except it becomes a curse because you start seeing flaws in everybody all the time. So we can see here, cervical is a lordosis. Thoracic is a kyphosis, lumbar is lordosis, sacral is kyphosis, and the coccyx, it just becomes kind of part of the kyphosis of the sacrum in terms of its orientation, right? So understand that kyphosis is concave anteriorly and lordosis is concave posteriorly. So we get that nice, lovely curve. And again, it's all about efficiency and longevity to it. So the thoracic and sacral curves are said to be developed in utero. Therefore, they are primary curves. So the thoracic and sacral curves occur inside mom, with just the way the spine develops and the structures that are related to it. The primary curves are the result of differences in height between the anterior and posterior parts. Now, the cervical and lumbar develop after birth. The cervical lordosis starts to develop when the child can lift their head up and hold their head continuously. And then the lumbar curve starts when the child can then walk. If you look at a newborn baby, they're like, their back is as flat as a board. You can have dinner off their back. Right? It's like a table. They don't develop those curves until the head can lift up and they can start to walk. Then the curves will start to develop as far as that goes. Okay? The fact that some people have abnormal curvatures can be due to abnormal development and pathological processes. So that's the other thing you're going to learn when you're palpating each other and over time treating people is what kind of curves do they have. You know, this is why, okay, this is, don't tell anybody I said this. I am dead against putting pillows under the belly. Yeah, it's been there. Really? Interesting. Yeah, I was trained that way. We always put a pillow under the belly. Here's the problem. If sitting is the problem in our society, which flattens the back, when you put a pillow under the tummy on the table, you flatten the back. Now, sometimes it's done because what it does is it opens up the space between the lower ribs and the pelvis. So you can get in at QL and into those areas much, much better as far as that goes. But I'm always about promoting lordosis because most people have poor lordosis in the lumbar spine. So I never put a pillow under belly. Not ever. But don't tell Michelle I said that. So some things that can affect the curves: osteoporosis, which is in a, you know, weakened bones; hyperkyphosis, which is a humpback. So sometimes it's called Dowager's hump, maybe a term that you've heard before. Highly genetic. If your grandmother has the big hump or whatever, you're likely going to get it too at that point. Some get like it's a bit of the fat pad here at the upper back. Scoliosis. Now scoliosis is a bit different, because that is not an anterior-posterior curve, that's a medial-lateral curve, right? So scoliosis looks like that. So the curves we're talking about over here, anterior-posterior in nature, this is medial-lateral, right? You're going to learn about scoliosis in your musculoskeletal pathology and in your treatments, but it has to do with actual vertebral rotations. So they rotate, which results in these curves, right? And you can see here, you know, here's your thoracic spine. Now, this is not even close to worrying about doing anything with it surgically or anything. So scoliosis is a curvature that's convex laterally. It can be the result of poorly developed vertebral bodies. It can also be the result of tight muscles on one side, weak muscles on the other, and those sorts of things. And then, of course, a hyperlordosis is increase of convex anterior, which is also known as sway back. So this is osteoporosis here. You can see that the vertebral bodies start to weaken because of the disease state. They start collapsing in on each other, and you start getting this excessive kyphosis, hyperkyphosis, because of the pathological state here. You'll note here the stomach even gets larger because as the rib cage comes down in that movement, the internal organs have no place to go, and the path of least resistance is the soft tissue of the abdomen, right? They have nowhere to go. So, because you're actually making the abdominal cavity smaller in that state. Here is hyperkyphosis that we can see here. This is hyperkyphosis as well with the hyperlordosis. Always remember, it's like a plumb bob, right? If you've ever seen a plumb bob, you guys know what a plumb bob is, right? No? So now we have lasers, right? So now if I want to draw a straight line on the wall to do tiles, I put a laser up, right? The old-fashioned way was, no, the plumb bob had a string with a weight on the bottom.
Yeah.
So it would run, the weight with the string would run perfectly straight up and down with the weight on it. So if I were to take, I'll just do this. This would be the easiest way to do it. If I take this, okay, and I go like this, you see how the bottom's always opposite to where I'm moving? Right? It's always opposite. So this is what happens. If you're going to get a curve one way, you get an excessive the other way. Our body, the best way to remember it is, you know, an airplane when you have the horizon, you know, in the little dial that's on their thing, right? You got the black and the white, and then you're always trying to keep the wings on the horizon. Our eyes are the same. The reason why we make adaptations quite often to twisting and turning is because the brain is always trying to keep the eyes at the horizon.
Okay?
One of the reasons is that can cause what's called torticollis, where the child's head kind of tilts because the eyes are out. Yeah. Yeah, but you can get it when you're born as well. So, and part of it is weak eyes or wise are in the wrong position, and the head will take this position because it's trying to get the eyes back to horizon. Yeah. Yeah. So you see, like lumbar, like a disc herniation, the patient will turn to one side and the upper body will go the other direction. You'll see patients come in and you'll go, how's your back? Not good. Yeah, exactly. And what they're trying to do is they're moving away because of the pain, that the upper spine has to make up the difference to keep the eyes of the horizon. We are a pretty fascinating thing, I'll tell you. Quite often. A lot of times, though, it's if one maintains a level of fitness and core strength, it tends to limit it quite a bit. And there comes a point where you have to ask yourself, like, actually, I would say more often with people who work out, I see hypokyphosis. Have you ever seen anybody in the gym setting where it looks like their shoulder blades or scapula are sticking way out, and then the spine right between the shoulder blades is just as flat at the table? You ever notice that? Yeah, that's hypokyphosis. And that has to do with a lot more, too much anterior work and not enough back work, for example. Yeah, because what's that? Yeah. I love them. So many people use them now. Because it actually, the research again has shown standing desks and better health is like, it's crazy how good they are for people. Especially with back issues, those sorts of things. You can see here is a hyperlordosis here. This is your classic gymnast, right? The excessive curve and the extended knees, hyperextended knees. This is the position. You can see you've got these red representing the tight muscles here. They're literally pulling the spine down and away. You can also see it here somewhere. But you can see, like, see how flat that is here and then gets it back again in that thoracic curvature. Okay? This is stuff to remember for clinic. So let's talk about a vertebra. So grab a vertebra. If we need one, come on up. Please just make sure I get one back. Get them back. If you want them, come and get them. I got lots here. I got big ones, small ones. You just can't have these two. Yeah, these, no. They won't talk to you, I promise. We mean stay with you. Come on. Why? They don't belong to anybody anymore.
I know that, but
they do. No, some are. Yeah. Okay. You'll note that you'll see that there's a roundish, large area, and then bones that stick out in all directions, right? Some bones that go to the side, some go to the back, and so forth. So there is a body, which is this part, okay? So we've got a body, which is the round part here, and then the bones that go out in all different directions is called the vertebral arch. So you have the body here, and then you have this part which is the vertebral arch. This is known as the vertebral arch, okay? They can vary in size, as I've shown you. They also have different characteristics from one region to the other, but their structure is basically the same. So we're going to talk first about what is a basic vertebra, and then when we get into the specific spines, we'll start talking about some of the modifications that the vertebra have as it compares to the standard vertebra, okay? So let's do the body first. The body represents the anterior part of the vertebra, okay? So every time you see it, the body is always anterior, the arch is posterior. So that's the setup, okay? As we've seen, they gradually become larger, particularly from T4 inferiorly, and it does represent the heavier part of the vertebra itself. This body is considered a short long bone. Don't ask me why. It just is. The body is considered a short long bone. Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense.
I guess a little bit.
It's got like the hollow.
Yeah, yeah. Diplo. Not bad. Spongy bone, yeah. It gives strength to the vertebral column, and of course, it's the body that carries the majority of the weight of the body on the spine at any given time. From C3 to S1, they become larger to progressively bear increasing body weight. So we've got the C-spine that kind of just holds up the head, and then as we work our way down, we get more and more compounded weight on top of the spine as we work our way down through the body. So again, here we can see the body that's here. The next is the vertebral arch, also known as the neural arch. So this is the more busy part of a vertebra, right? The body anteriorly, this is the posterior part. So of course, you guys have already palpated spinous processes, correct? Okay, so that is one of the parts of the arch or the neural arch of the vertebra. So you already palpated it, so this is a structure that goes posteriorly back off the body. The vertebral arch lies posterior to the vertebral body and it is attached to the vertebral body. There is a space within the middle of it, which Nick was putting his finger in as a wedding ring, and that represents the foramen that the neural tissues go through. In other words, the spinal cord and its nerve roots, depending on what level we're at. Okay, so where my finger is where you would find the spinal cord that runs through this foramen. It's formed by two pedicles, two lamina, four articular processes, two transverse processes, and one spinous process. So let's have a look at them. So here we have the body, and the vertebral arch attaches to the body posteriorly via the pedicles. Pedicles means little feet. So you will see that you have two pillars or posts on either side, and this is where the arch attaches to the body. These are the pedicles, one on either side. Now, they can vary as to where they are on the body, but for now, we'll just say they go straight back, okay? That the arch attaches to the body via the pedicles. So far, so good? Yes? Don't worry about the dip. So we're going to look at it from this perspective. This perspective and say, there's your two pedicles there in there. Okay? Okay. What's that?
Like right here?
Yeah, those two pillars, those two posts, those are called the pedicles.
Okay.
Okay? All right. So we have the two pedicles. Then we have the two lamina. We'll get to those, I think, and then the four articular process. I think I do it afterwards. Yes. Okay. Let's do that. Okay? The arch encloses an aperture. This is known where the spinal cord goes through. That hole the spinal cord goes through is known as the vertebral foramen. Okay, so this is known as the vertebral foramen. Successive vertebral foramina form the vertebral canal, which contains the spinal cord, its skins or meninges, nerve roots, and blood vessels. So if you take the full, yeah. Yes, but it's called the spinal canal when we line it all up. So when it's lined up properly, we can twist and turn these kind of fitting right. Yeah, that's right. We line them all up appropriately. You guys put your... Oh, you put the holes in the body. Okay, I thought you put the cords through the vertebral canal. So all those foramina make that vertebral canal, which runs all the way down through. So if we were through it, we would see if there's a canal that would run all the way through the column itself, okay? Success, and then we find the spinal cord in there. So here we've got, here's our body, here's our pedicles. So the pedicles, there are two pedicles. They're attached to the body, and they are continuous posteriorly with what is known as the lamina. So I'm going to start drawing. No. Yeah. Lamina tends to mean layer, right? Okay, so we have the body. Next, we have the pedicles. Okay, they're coming off. We're saying that attached to the body are the pedicles, and they're continuous posteriorly with the flat lamina. So coming off of here, are the lamina. All right? I made that a G. You don't want that to be a G. Okay. Now, when we do it, we'll do a vertebra this way as well. Ryan. Okay. So again, here's our body. Here's our pedicle. And our lamina is kind of in this area here. All right? Now, there's a small notch superior to each pedicle called the superior vertebral notch, which varies in size at different levels of the vertebral column. So we can see here, right here, we can see a notch here. That is known as the vertebral notch. Okay? You would sort of see it. We're looking down on top of it, so it's a bit difficult. There is a notch inferior to each pedicle, and this is the inferior notch. Now, I'm going to place another vertebra in this picture. So first, I'm going to put a disc in, and then I'm going to... pretend that there's a... And we're gonna bring it up the other side. No, they're just like your symphysis pubis. So you've got your two articular cartilage there, and then the fibrous disc in between. So the same idea. So we have our disc, and we have our inferior notch and our superior notch. So we're saying there's a notch inferior to each pedicle called the inferior vertebral notch, which is usually larger than the superior. When two vertebrae articulate together, the vertebral notches are adjacent to each other and form an almost complete bony ring called the intervertebral foramen. So this right here, so we've got the superior notch of this vertebra and the inferior notch of this vertebra make a huge hole here. Yes. Is above? Yes. Correct. Yes, that's where they come out. So we're saying here, dorsal and ventral nerve roots are found in the vertebral canal, and the spinal ganglia are found in the intervertebral foramen. So the ability of the nervous system, the central nervous system, spinal cord that's running through the spinal column, nerves exit and enter into the spinal cord via the intervertebral foramen. Okay? Those nerves that are coming into the spinal cord are sensory in nature, so it tells us about what we feel and tickle and those sorts of things. And those nerves that exit the intervertebral foramen are motor, so they're the nerves that are going to stimulate a muscle to contract. Okay? But that's how they get in and they get out. So you can see it here. So here is your superior notch of this level and your inferior notch of this level. Together they form this bony ring, and this is known as the intervertebral foramen, and this is how nerves enter and exit into the spinal cord, is via that. Okay? Everybody follow that? All right? And you can see here, with the bones removed, here's your body, here's your arch. We can see the spinal cord running through here in the center, and we can see the what we call nerve roots that are exiting or entering out from the spinal cord. Now, just to the side, if this disc starts to deteriorate and disappear and get thinner, what's going to happen to the intervertebral foramen? It's going to get narrower. And that can put pressure on a nerve root, which causes neurological dysfunction distal to the nerve. It could cause pain patterns. It could cause numbness and tingling in fingers or toes or those sorts of things. This is very common to see when we talk about disc degeneration disease. The vertebrae are starting to get closer together because the discs are disappearing. The intervertebral foramen gets smaller, and then you get compression on nerve roots, again, which can cause numbness, tingling, pain patterns, all sorts of things. No such thing as a slip disc. I'll get to that. You can have a slip vertebra, but you can't have a slip disc. Who don't which? The amount of pressure that's placed on the disc, this disc is unbelievably ridiculous. So if you're deadlifting 800 pounds, it's times 10 on one disc if you don't do them right. It still causes a lot of pressure on it. I avoid them at all costs unless you are in super shape. 300 pounds is still, and that's per square inch. So I'm not talking just straight. That's per square inch. So if you're doing 300 pounds, that's 3,000 pounds per square inch on that disc.
But you can still deadlift like a lower weight.
You can for sure. Absolutely. It's just, it's interesting to me because deadlifting has become, it's become this like, everybody thinks that they're absolutely necessary and there's no other way to perform the task for what you're after with other exercises, which is completely incorrect because there are other exercises that can do the same thing. You can do deadlifts if you are trained properly and in shape to do deadlifts, even at the low end. Because if you think about it, people have deteriorated discs just from sitting all the time, and that's just your body weight. Right? So imagine now you're putting 300-pound bars or 250-pound bar or 200-pound weight or even 100. You've got to extrapolate it down to that single disc at pounds per square inch times 10. Because of the way it just mathematically works on the disc itself, with the accumulated compound of weight through the functional movement that occurs. I got to find that slide for Matt. I should ask him for it, and I'll show it to you. Especially if it's not done right. If it's done right, it's fine. As long as that curve's maintained and that bum sticks out and they go down appropriately, you're completely fine. But I see so many people get too much weight and they do this, and they round out, and now you're done. Right? Now you're done. So yeah, as long as that bum gets out there nice and that got you maintain that lordosis, you're good to go. There's no problem with the squat.
Is that the right hyperlordosis?
No, it's just you are deliberately making it hyperlordotic to force it to come down through the appropriate movement. It's just, yeah, people just get too heavy too fast. Next thing you see is this, and it's like, Yeah, the first thing is, you don't know if you do it right. You think you are.
Yeah.
You would need an expert to watch you and critique you, or even have somebody video you.
I've got 3 years of
Yeah, and make sure it's done completely correct as far as that goes. Then you're it's still it can be done somewhat safe, but not necessarily. Ask what's his name? Is it Ronnie Coleman? Yeah, like Ronnie's body is. Yeah. Oh yes, he was. Absolutely. Yes and no. It's a little more complicated than that, because one needs to maintain strength along with aerobic capacity to maintain good health, right? And good weight and those sorts of things. So strength training is integral to an overall fitness program, right? Not just cardio like we used to think. One needs to be strong as well. And then, of course, on top of that, it's balance and core and all those sorts of things. That's the other thing with a deadlift. What's your core strength? Because that's the other thing that absolutely has to be in place to do an appropriate deadlift, is that core needs to be ripping strong. So you need to consider a lot of those things. You can see why it is an exercise that's been adopted to all levels of fitness in the gym, but ultimately it is a, if you were to make a continuum of fitness, there are certain exercises like deadlifts, but I'm thinking also plyometrics. I don't know if you've ever done plyometrics. You know the jumping pads, you know, the jump onto the pads and the jump down, that's all plyometrics. Those are only for top fitness people, but you see them in the gym and everybody's doing them. Yeah. All the training I took was like plyometrics. You don't even look at for a person unless they're extremely fit, because the potential for injury is so high. So they have to be fit and strong. Don't get me started on CrossFit. You have no idea how many patients I've seen out of CrossFit. And what I don't like about CrossFit is in the exercises. What I don't like is people are motivated to do things they're not in fit, the proper fitness level to be doing, and they just screw themselves up. Yeah, because everybody's yelling and, come on, one more. Oh, what was that? Right? Okay. The next are these lamina that I was talking about. So there are vertebral processes. The vertebral processes that we talked about with the articular processes, the transverse processes, and the spinous processes, they all arise from the lamina. Typically, there are 7 processes, and there are 3 that are lever-like, which is for muscle attachment, and 4 are articular. The superior articular processes articulate with the inferior articular process of the superior vertebra. So let's take see if I can find here a couple that will match a bit. Okay. So when we look here at this vertebra, these 2, and I like thoracic for this, we can see that we have the vertebral body here, and then we have the 2 pedicles. We can see that we have this broad kind of flat on either side of the spinous process here. See it here and here. Okay, this is the lamina. Okay, this sort of represents the lamina. We then have the 4 articular processes. Here are the 2 superior articular processes, and here are the 2 inferior articular processes. So we have the 2 superior, and we have the 2 inferior. Okay, so you've got the lamina, the pedicles, the body, and the articular processes arise out of the lamina. Okay, everybody got me so far? This is about, this is probably about T6, T5. Yeah, that's because you're a lumbar vertebra and yours are lined up a bit differently. So we're going to learn that, yes, although every vertebra does have all these processes, it's their relationship to each other and how they function in relationship to each other that allows all the particular movement that any part of the spine has. So obviously there's far more movement in the cervical spine as compared to the thoracic spine, right? There's no rotation in the lumbar spine and so forth because of the way they relate to each other. So for right now, we're just, what are the basic components? And then when we get into the specific spines, then we'll talk about how they relate to each other and how that promotes the kind of movement and strength and so on and so forth. So body, pedicles, lamina, we have the 4 articular processes, 2 superior, 2 inferior, okay? We're saying that the inferior processes of the superior vertebra articulate with the superior processes of the vertebra inferior. Does that make sense? Right? The inferior processes articulate with the superior processes of the vertebra below. And you'll note I left the space there on purpose because what's supposed to go in there? Right, the disc goes in there. Can you see the intervertebral foramen now? Right? See the space between the notches? So that would be where your nerve roots go in and out depending on what you're using. Okay? So we can see them here. Here's our articulating processes here. Here's the lamina, the pedicle, and of course our vertebral body. The articular processes, where the two articular processes come together, they form a glide joint. Now, if any of you have had the chiropractic work done or some physio, you may have heard that you have a facet problem. Have you heard that term before? Some of you? Okay. The true anatomical name for the joint that's created by the articular processes is actually called the zygapophyseal joint. That is its correct name, zygapophyseal joint. Okay? Zygapophyseal joint. So the common name is the facet, but its anatomical name is the zygapophyseal joint. This is the articulation between the articular process of the vertebral arch. Of course, it helps prevent anterior movement, in this case, in some cases, right? And it is the placement of this joint that influences what kind of movement occurs in the relationship between the vertebra, whether we're talking C-spine, T-spine, or L-spine. We have different movements in each of those spines, right? Right. Obviously, our head, our C-spine, is got a lot more range of motion than the rest. Think of an owl. Imagine what kind of vertebra an owl has. And holding structures, because they can see their own bum, right? They can turn all the way around, almost see completely around behind them. Again, structure governs function. You know, imagine how theirs is set up. By the way, how many vertebrae does a giraffe have compared to a human in the C-spine? I already told you that one. Yeah, because it's just size. So you can see here in this diagram, here we have C5 and C6. Here is our disc that's between the two of them. And there's a particular configuration that's happening here between the inferior articulating process of C5 and the superior articulating process of C6. We're going to learn that this kind of oblique kind of relationship is what allows our cervical spine to have as much range as it does. That allows for rotation, flexion, extension, and lateral flexion. Okay? So it's that orientation that allows for that. Here we've got a little more of a lumbar spine, and we can see here the articulation is entirely different. So where the C-spine in anterior, posterior was like this, the L-spine's like this. So it can't rotate at all. Right? It bangs up to the side, so it can't rotate. It's made for flexion and extension.
What is movement here like?
T-spine. If you... Come on up. See if we can. Okay. So, watch. Yep, face them. Okay, just plant your feet about shoulder width apart. Rotate to the left. Okay. So you think that's all spinal rotation, right? To some degree. Correct?
Yes.
Yeah. It's not. It's spine and pelvis. Now I'm going to hold her pelvis. Now rotate.
Yeah.
See the difference? Okay, now I'm going to put my hand here and hold the pelvis. This represents lumbar. Now rotate. You can see the lumbar is not rotating at all. Lumbar spine does not rotate. It's all T-spine. Okay, and that, again, has to do with the relationship of the facet joints as they relate to each other individually. The thing to always remember when it comes to range of motion in the spine, we'll do the math. So there's 12 thoracic vertebra. Let's say every single vertebra rotates 1/2 inch. How much rotation would that allow for? So it'd be, there's 12 vertebra. They can all rotate 1/2 inch each. We add them all together. That equals 6 inches. Okay? So that's how it works. You take the minor movement that occurs between each vertebra, but when you add them all together, you get the accumulation of what you see as a normal movement. So now if I remove one thoracic vertebra because you have a muscle spasm or you have osteoarthritis in that joint, you've just removed a half an inch of rotation. This is why we lose as we get older, because we may have a bit of osteoarthritis in there and that joint doesn't move as much, so it starts to limit our range. Or you're going to learn in assessments, I may put a thumb on a vertebra and make it not move and just do the one above and then the one next one above and the next one above to get a sense. And you're going to find in some patients, let's say, for example, T5, T6, they're not rotating at all for lots of reasons, tight muscles, whatever it may be. Now you got to get it moving and grooving, okay? The transverse processes, they do exactly that. They go transversely. They project laterally from the junction of the pedicles and the lamina. They act as attachments for muscles, helping to increase leverage over the vertebral column. So now we have body, pedicles, lamina, articulating processes, superior and inferior, and transverse processes going out either side transversely along the transverse plane, and you get a lot of muscle attachment there. The last one is a single one. It goes out directly posteriorly. This is called the spinous process, projects posteriorly or posterior inferiorly. So we're going to see our lumbar vertebra kind of goes almost straight back, but look how far down the spinous process goes in a T-spine. Goes down almost two levels, we're going to discover. Actually travels down rather than straight out, okay? And we'll get back to that when we talk about T-spine. They project posteriorly or posterior inferiorly in the median plane from the place of union of the lamina. They serve as attachments for the inner spinous and supraspinous ligaments, which we'll do a bit later. And these ligaments, of course, help strengthen the vertebral column and provide posterior support. So we can see C-spine and how everything kind of lines up. We've got vertebral bodies, pedicles, lamina, articulating processes, transverse processes, and spinous processes here. Here is the thoracic spine. You can see the configuration. They're all there. They just look a bit different. Pedicles, lamina, transverse processes, spinous. And then there's our lumbar. And we can see yet again, just slightly modified differently again. And again, structure governs function. The way they all relate to each other in their three different ways is what results in providing strength or movement, depending on what the body's after, okay? All right, I guess that's it. Yeah, I'd like to have got the